The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts and help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and their tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/bluewire. That's 60% off at babbel.com/bluewire, spelled BABBEL.com/bluewire. Rules and restrictions apply.
You don't want it, you don't need it, but you're gonna get it anyway. The Kevin Sheehan Show. Here's Kevin.
At this point, none of my thoughts are about the previous game. It's all about what's our new game plan and what's our mindset going into Denver this week, and how can I attack that and get to know the plan and get to know the defense as best as I can going into Sunday. So I'm really not focused on anything really that happened in the game. Obviously, there's some things throughout the week that we know that came up in the game that we'd like to do a better job of, but all my focus is on the game plan for Denver.
That was Sam Howell from earlier today. Wednesday is media day for the quarterback in the NFL, and Sam did address a lot of what happened on Sunday, but eventually got to the point where he was ready to move on to week two and their showdown with the Broncos in Denver on Sunday. The show's presenting sponsor is WinDonation. Call them at 866-90-NATION or go to WinDonation.com. Mention my name. They'll take good care of you. You'll get a free estimate. Again, 866-90-NATION or WinDonation.com. Thanks to WinDonation. Two guests on the show today. Scott Van Pelt will be on in the next segment. Mark Zuckerman after that. Nats GM Mike Rizzo finally got that contract extension today. Good for him. And I think good for us as well. I'll also ask Mark about the Steven Strasburg retirement situation that has gotten a bit sideways. For those of you asking about a Cooley film breakdown for this week, maybe later in the week or perhaps next week. He is busy. I do know that on Sunday he heard from Alex Ovechkin very early in the morning, who was wondering why Cooley wasn't at the game on Sunday, because Alex Ovechkin was. So were a lot of other athlete celebrities on Sunday at the game, including Philadelphia 76ers center Joel Embiid. Of course, Washington's new owner, Josh Harris, he owns the Sixers. And Embiid came down to the game and sat in the owner's box, took pictures with Josh Harris and others. There's one picture in particular of Embiid and Kevin Durant with Josh Harris. And that picture was commented on by longtime Philadelphia sports personality Howard Eskin. Howard Eskin quote tweeted that picture, or whatever we call it now on X. Is it a quote repost? Whatever. He wrote this about Josh Harris with Joel Embiid in this picture. He wrote, quote, "Tone deaf is one way to describe this photo. Which fans are more offended? Philly sports fans, Eagles, or Sixers fans? Can't figure out who's more asinine. The owner of the Commanders and 76ers, Josh Harris, for asking Joel Embiid to appear at a Commanders home opener as ambassador for a rival Philadelphia team, or Embiid for agreeing to it. A Sixer is insulting to his biggest fan base when supporting a rival of the Eagles. Does anybody in Philadelphia even respect or like Josh Harris? Hashtag clearly tone deaf." That was Howard Eskin, longtime Philadelphia WIP Eagles radio network guy, rather opinionated, as you know, many in this business are. He's a polarizing personality in that market, has been for a long time. I've had Howard on my show many times, on the radio show. I think I've had him on the podcast. I just had him on recently, in fact, to talk about Josh Harris. And he's not a fan of Josh Harris. I think I basically told him in that interview that it really doesn't matter much about Josh Harris. We would have taken Lee Harvey Oswald as the new owner if he were still alive, if it meant that we didn't have to have Dan anymore, to which Howard actually agreed, yeah, Dan's much worse. But he's not a fan of Josh Harris, thinks that, you know, basically it's a business to him and, you know, making money is the priority, not winning. That's his take. Now, as far as Harris goes, I like Josh Harris so far. I haven't mentioned this, but I have had a chance to meet him and have a conversation with him. And I think he's smart. I think he's genuine. I think he's far different than Dan in a lot of ways, but one way more than any other. He's not arrogant. You know, there's a humility to him, as well as the biggest minority owner in the franchise, Mitch Rales. Like, that is a far different, you know, personality trait with this ownership group compared to Dan and his group. I had somebody text me on Sunday, late Sunday, to say, you know, one of the things that was noticeable pregame was Dan wasn't walking around the field, you know, with his henchmen just dripping arrogance, and said that these guys were engaging and they were friendly to anybody and everybody. Yeah, look, they're enjoying the attention that comes with this new team, as they should. And they're also in that, you know, mode of really trying to, you know, let everybody know, hey, it's a new day. Dan's gone and we're not Dan. And so far, I think that's true. But anyway, from my perspective so far, it's been so far so good, no matter what Howard Eskin thinks. But look, we needed this. We had to have this. And that's something that Philadelphia fans, Eagles fans anyway, don't really understand or get with Jeffrey Lurie having owned that team for as long as he's owned it now. But Howard Eskin did have a point about Embiid being in the box at a Washington game when Washington is a division rival of the Eagles, who are a team in the city in which he plays NBA basketball. You know, we didn't like it, or some of us didn't like it, when John Wall had an Emmitt Smith Cowboys jersey on at a Redskins Cowboys game, walking around on the sideline. Bryce Harper never hid how big of a fan of the Cowboys he was. You know, you really, look, you can't count on players these days to figure that kind of thing out, unless they are really in touch with their city and their fan bases. I'm sure, by the way, at this point, it would have been much worse for Eagles fans had Embiid been in Jerry Jones's box or even in the Mara's box in the Meadowlands. Our team isn't the rival for their fan base that the other two teams in the division are. Look, the part of what we've had to suffer through is horrible teams, horrible ownership, but also the loss of our standing in the division. You know, we're not really the Cowboys' chief rival anymore. That's the Eagles. The Eagles' chief rival is the Cowboys, and maybe that's always been the case. But, you know, we were a big part of the mix of rivalries in the division, and, you know, they've just beaten the shit out of us for so long, and they've understood, those fan bases have understood, and those organizations have understood that, you know, we're at the bottom of the barrel. I don't know. Look, in Joel Embiid's case, okay, he was there with his owner, his boss, the guy that owns the NBA team that he played for. What's he supposed to do, say no? Yeah, but I doubt that he even really knew that this might, you know, generate an actual response. Maybe Josh Harris shouldn't have put him in that position. But you know what? Like, This is an old school thing, I think. Fans like Eskin are the only ones who really care because rivalries aren't nearly as important as I think they used to be, or they're not as important as they are with older fans. They aren't as important with younger fans as they are with older fans, excuse me. It's certainly with professional sports. Anyway, I thought that was kind of entertaining. I think we reacted similarly to John Wall being in that Cowboys jersey and Bryce Harper on, you know, during an All-Star game asking Joe Buck and about, you know, the Cowboys and whether or not, you know, Dak and Zeke were healthy, I think was the question several years ago. Don't forget to rate us and review us. Very important for us, especially on Apple and Spotify. And I mentioned this with Tommy yesterday. If you've had some issues, and a couple of you have had issues, more than a couple of you, although it's a minority percentage of those that are listening, and it hasn't happened to me yet, but some of you have had, for whatever reason, on Apple and Spotify, when the show is downloaded, you've just gotten ads, like 4 to 5 minutes of ads. We have tried to figure that out. We are trying to figure that out. We did put it. It wasn't us. It's our publishing platform, a company called Megaphone. And I think they've tweaked something, so we're hopeful that it won't happen again. But just a reminder that if it does happen, you can always just listen to the show on the website at KevinSheehanShow.com or TheKevinSheehanShow.com. Both URLs will pop up the show with a big button that you hit play on, and you can listen to the show that way if you end up having issues. But I do apologize for those issues. Rate us and review us if you have time, you know, on Apple in particular. It's always good to get a rating and a review because it really does help our ability to generate revenue. This from Billy Ho. Love the show, especially during football season. Met Tom before. Would love to run into you. By the way, he titled his review, Kirk Stinks, but did give us 5 stars. And then this from Neil. Neil titled his review, STMS, Sheehan Time Management Services. And he wrote, once again, the clock whisperer enlightens us. Seriously, though, the second you said to run out of bounds at the 9.5-yard line, I said out loud, because you can't get a first down. Great take. Yeah, I was talking about what I thought. Again, it was a weird situation. Andy Reid in that first game last Thursday night going for a 4th and 25, you know, with still 3 timeouts left. Like, we've never seen that really happen before. And so it just occurred to me and my son, we were sitting there watching it, what if he had just taken it and run backwards to the 9.5-yard line? At that point, it would have absolutely guaranteed that the Chiefs would have gotten the ball back because Detroit couldn't have made a first down and run the clock out. They would have gotten the ball back, worst case, down 8 with a chance to score, 2-point conversion tie. More likely than not, down 4. And it's possible they could have gotten it down 1 if Detroit turned it over or missed a field goal. It's also possible Detroit could have gone for 2 and gone up by 9, but that was the only way to guarantee getting the ball back. And the context of that particular moment was Andy Reid clearly did not believe in his defense. Anyway, rate us, review us, especially on Apple and Spotify. And again, if you've had some issues with Apple and Spotify, just go to thekevinsheehanshow.com. That is always there. The show always gets posted there. And even though it is posted on a similar platform, no one's had an issue listening via the website show platform. So anyway, by the way, I talked a little bit about Denver yesterday in the game that they had played against the Raiders and that there were only 6 possessions in the game, which was crazy. The other thing about that game that I didn't realize until I watched more of it last night, Sean Payton opened up that game with an onside kick The first look at Sean Payton's Denver Broncos for Denver Bronco fans was an onside kick. Amazing. Remember, he did that in Super Bowl 44 to start the second half against the Colts as the Saints coach, and it ended up being one of the really big plays of that Super Bowl, which is the only Super Bowl that the Saints have ever won. The other thing also real quickly about Denver, and I'll have more on this on Friday, they are not explosive offensively. They move the football, and a lot of the Russell Wilson completions, and he had 27 of them, were typical Russ Wilson plays, you know, vintage Seattle Russell Wilson, where he's moving around and outside of the pocket, extending the play. A lot of off-schedule completions, including the two touchdowns. Look, Russ has never been a big-time pocket passer. His best work has been done outside of the pocket. And that's what you noticed from the game on Sunday, is that, you know, Russ has struggled from the pocket in part because of his size over the years. But I thought he did a good job outside of the pocket. But they're not an explosive offensive team. Cortland Sutton's out there, but no Jerry Jeudy this week. No Jerry Jeudy in the opener. No Jerry Jeudy this week. Tim Patrick got hurt before the season started. I am a Javonte Williams fan, their running back, and I think Samaje Perine has looked pretty good for them as well. I'm looking forward to this matchup because I do think it's a winnable game. Look, they're playing a team that's more interested and better than the team they just played, but it's not an explosive offensive team, and I think it could be another game in which the defense shines. We shall see. Denver's defense is capable, and again, it's going to be better than what they faced on Sunday overall. Anyway, Denver, a 3.5-point favorite on Sunday, where the weather is supposed to be beautiful. 83 and sunny in Denver. That's not a humid 83 either, not at 5,280 feet. 5,280, right, equals a mile. I'm pretty sure it's 5,280. Before we get to Scott, I wanted to talk about Eric Bieniemy here for just a moment or two. I was constructively critical of the play calling on Sunday against Arizona because I thought there were too many dropbacks. I thought there were too many passes. And I didn't think that there was an adjustment to the fact that the game's result was being put at risk by dropping back Sam as much as they dropped him back. And look, they had, you know, they took six sacks and had three turnovers and still won the game. That's pretty remarkable. And it's also a reflection of just how bad Arizona is. They were playing a guy that, for all intents and purposes, is really a third-string NFL quarterback in Josh Dobbs. But I also pointed out that there could have been perhaps, you know, a long-term thought, a long-term plan with Eric Bieniemy. So I want to talk a little bit about that because I actually think I may be onto something here. So they came out and they were chucking the ball all around the park. I mean, at one point, I think it was 33, you know, called pass plays, including plays that ended in penalties, et cetera, that didn't actually count on the play sheet. But in terms of what was called in the huddle, at one point, I think it was 33-11. All right, passes over runs. And that went from first half into the first two series of the third quarter. And then the approach changed. And I had talked about the other day that there's a long-term thinking here as it relates to not only Sam Howell, but the kind of offense that Eric Bieniemy wants to coach. In today's NFL, it's really hard to win big and win often over a period of years without being able to throw the football. You know, game-managing quarterbacks and game-managed teams aren't sustained winners typically, and they're not consistent threats to go deep into the postseason. And Eric Bieniemy just came from a team that has been a consistent Super Bowl threat year in and year out since Patrick Mahomes took over. But, you know, even Andy Reid has always had sustained winners and has always understood that today's game, you've got to be able to throw the football. You have to think aggressively. And I think that part of the Eric Bieniemy plan here is to play it aggressively and to err on the side of being aggressive. And that's the game plan. Like, you can talk about there weren't a lot of wrinkles, there wasn't enough, you know, trickeration, there wasn't enough Kansas City in some of the plays and play design. Well, it's early. And by the way, he doesn't have Patrick Mahomes or Tariq Hill or Travis Kelce. But I think that winning the game is important. Of course, they want to win every game. But if they go down, they want to go down thinking aggressively and becoming a team that can throw the football. And by the way, it's easy to think that way with this particular group because, A, he's got a quarterback that can actually make every throw and, by the way, has some mobility and is coachable. But most importantly is it's actually the strength of the offense, the pass catchers, the wide receivers. So he wants the ball in their hands. And so I just think that there is a mindset with Eric Bieniemy. It's one game, and I've cautioned all week about one game, especially week one. But I can't wait to see what the game plan is for Denver. I can't wait to see if he continues to let Sam go back and drop back and throw it a lot more than they run it. Ultimately, it balanced out, but it wasn't the way games typically balance out, right? Usually, you know, you throw it to get the lead, you run it to run the clock out and win the game. They were losing for much of the game, and they ran it to take the lead after trailing. Like, they decided, well, we've put this game at too much risk, and we didn't think that the game would be at this much risk. Maybe they're thinking they thought they could certainly throw the football. That was part of the thinking. But I, you know, in terms of it wasn't that, oh, we're just going to come out here and throw it. It doesn't matter what it results in because it's going to be a learning experience. But I do think that the learning experience that he wants Sam to learn that we're going to throw the football and we're going to be aggressive and you're going to take some lumps here early in your career as a starter, and you're going to have to grow from those experiences. I don't want you to grow from game managing experiences. I want you to grow from being aggressive. You know, a lot of coaches will also always say in any sport, I don't care if you make a mistake, but I want it made full speed. And I think that's Eric Bieniemy's mindset. I do. But I think on Sunday, because the game actually had been put at risk by being too aggressive, that when they got that big turnover from Montez Sweat, they decided, okay, we're not going to drop back and potentially take a sack and get knocked out of field goal range and then have to punt and let them, you know, fool around, you know, being, and I'm talking about that drive at the second turnover when they were up 17-16. And you know, we'll take the 4-point lead because that should be good enough for a win. And so he ran Brian Robinson Jr. three times. But even on the drive after the Sweat turnover, the touchdown drive that gave them the lead, you know, we started to see an emphasis on not putting the game at risk. They needed a touchdown. They were down 16-10, but it was Brian Robinson, Brian Robinson, Brian Robinson, Brian Robinson. And then on first and goal from the 8, Sam Howell, incomplete, Chris Rodriguez for a 2-yard gain, and then they dropped Sam Howell back and he scrambled for a touchdown. But the mindset changed when the game became, became a major risk in terms of losing it. I said this on Monday that maybe there's a method to this. Maybe he wants to think in terms of developing this young quarterback in a way in which we're going to throw the football, because that's the way you win big in this league. And it may put the team at risk at times of being in a closer game than they want to be in, or maybe losing a game. But that there's some long-term thinking here. And I think to a certain level, I may be correct on some of that. So I want to see, I can't wait to see how this Denver game gets handled. Who knows? They might come out and just try to ram it down their throat with the run and be much more balanced in the first half than they were. But I think there was a message that Eric Bieniemy's, you know, was giving to Sam Howell, giving to this offense, that we're going to be a team that not only improves, but we're going to be a team that improves, that has it, when we improve, we're going to have a chance to win big, not just go 9-8 and be a 7 seed. And that may not happen this year. It may happen next year with Sam, or the year after. So overall, I liked the aggressiveness. I loved the aggressiveness at the end of the first half. And I just think watching Eric Bieniemy call these games was always a big storyline heading into this season, but it's become even more interesting to me after one game. But we'll see. The one game may have just been the one game. Scott Van Pelt next, right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This segment of the show brought to you by my good friends at MyBookie. Go to MyBookie.ag. Use my promo code KevinDC. On a deposit of $50 or more, you can receive up to $200 in cash instantly into your MyBookie account. Bet your deposit amount just one time, and you can withdraw at any time, but you've got to use my promo code KevinDC to claim your cash deposit. You can bet anything, anytime, anywhere, only with MyBookie. Jumping on with me right now is my good friend, Scott Van Pelt from ESPN. First of all, did you check out how the odds makers adjusted the totals for week two in the NFL? See how low they are?
No.
You know, it was a very low scoring week one. Unders were 12-4. And there are like four or five games that are in the high 30s to like 40 in terms of totals. So I don't know I don't know what's going on. It was a low scoring week one. There were some weather issues, I think, in some places, but I don't know. It looks like defense is ahead of offense at this time of the year. How are you doing? How was Monday night at MetLife?
It was fun. It's a great reminder of what it's like to be in the middle of something like that. The atmosphere before was unbelievable. I mean, it was a city that was in a frenzy, and then the air comes out of the balloon when Rodgers gets hurt, and then it ends with this walk-off, and it's 80-something thousand people going just bananas, and then you're on TV a second later. And then there's nothing that's quite like that, and so being in the middle of it was great fun.
You know, you told me that just the feeling before kickoff and the electricity in that building, the energy in that building. And you and I both know what a stadium or an arena that's really jacked up feels like. Mm-hmm. Where did this rank?
I mean, it doesn't get much higher. I mean, like, what's the volume go to, right? I mean, it's the old Spinal Tap joke. It goes to 11. I mean, this was at 11. It was the kind of thing where, you know, the stadiums now, they're different from the old days of, I mean, our memories of RFK, which are might as well be 100 years ago. But, I mean, every stadium's got pyrotechnics and lights and you know, the stereo sound is, you know, the speakers are out of, you know, it's ear-splitting, and I'm damn near deaf. So it's I mean, it's all of that. But then it's just you're waiting, and it's September 11th, and you're just outside of New York City, and guys are coming out with American flags, and here comes Aaron Rodgers. And they've been waiting for decades, forever, for a moment like this where they all buy in, and then it's you know, Charlie Brown with a football. It's just impossible. Impossible how it went from 11 to 0. And that building was you can understand it. I mean, they're just like, you've got to be kidding me. And the defense gives them a chance, keeps them in it, and you know, like, that's a game, if you're Buffalo, you just can't lose. You just can't lose that game, and they did. And it was, I mean, the before and after were amazing. The middle was, you know, it was understandably flat.
Yeah, I mean, it was just such a stunning occurrence, four snaps into it, and I think everybody was just completely jaw-dropped in that moment, and then it was just waiting to see what it was. Scott, for those of you who don't know, and my guess is most of you do know, is now hosting Monday Night Football's pregame on ESPN with RG3, with Marcus, with Spears, with Ryan Clark, and a lot of others, and it's off to a great start. You know, just tell everybody, this is a different role for you. You've done so much in so many different ways, play-by-play of golf and the big majors and obviously SportsCenter and so many things, but what's this been like through the first, you know, well, you did the Baltimore game here in Washington during the preseason, but that really didn't match what Monday night was like. No, so what's the gig like?
It's interesting just because it is different and it feels different. You know, they gave me SportsCenter to do with it what I wanted, right? I mean, it was me sitting out there by myself, my man Stanford Steve in the studio, but not sitting next to me. And it was just a total departure, and it was a blank canvas, do what you want with it. Monday Night Countdown, there are people on the production side and in front of the camera who have been on it before, and I'm sensitive to that. I don't want to come in and just start elbowing my way up to the bar and say, all right, here's what we're going to do, because I don't think that doesn't feel like being a real good teammate. At the same time, they didn't put me out there to be a traffic cop either. So this was the first show we ever did. It's 9/11. It's New York. It's Aaron Rodgers. It's not like you get to kind of test the water. You're diving in the deep end right off the bat. And then there's weather that arrives an hour before, and you can't do the show on the field. They send you up to some club level deal where four guys sitting on chairs in a suite. I mean, it wasn't the smoothest way to try to take off, but I was really pleased because I felt largely like myself. And what I mean by that, Kevin, is, I mean, you know me, I'm very comfortable with myself. I'm very comfortable with the role in SportsCenter. So I think when you watch me, I think largely you know me as well as anyone. Like, that's me. I really don't alter myself. I didn't want to feel like I was playing some role or being some version of me that wasn't me, and I didn't. And so I was pleased with that. That it felt like, me largely. The one thing I told them when we talked about this beforehand was, I don't tend to watch pregame NFL shows, and I just don't understand why the networks feel the need to have like an all 22. On a set, like, what are we doing? No one can get a word in edgewise. It's just, I don't know what the point is of so many shows where it's just there's like 20 people. What are we doing?
I agree.
And we don't have that for the most part. I mean, there are segments where it's two or three of us. There's one segment where you're making picks, and it's everyone who's there. Alex Smith, who's there, who's just a phenomenal guy. For the first one, if this is where we start, then I'm optimistic about how, as we all get more comfortable with one another, we'll get to a place where we all feel great about it. I had no idea what it would feel like, and thankfully, as I say, I felt comfortable. I didn't feel like I was kind of a passenger along for the ride. I didn't know where we were going.
Real quickly about the game, not about the game, about the future of the Jets and Aaron Rodgers. Do you think he plays again?
I tend to. I think he put so much into this and invested so much in it emotionally, just with his time, just trying to get all these young guys on that Jet side kind of all aligned and see his vision and all the rest of that bit. I just can't imagine that he wouldn't. Having said that, Kevin, you know, I've done golf my whole career, and Tiger was going to catch Jack. Like, there was no other option. Well, okay, then your back gets fused and you have a million different surgeries, and you don't always get to write your own walk-off. You don't always get to choose it. So my guess is that this is the type of injury that would allow him to heal completely. He'd be 40 years old. I know he was energized completely in New York in a way that, you know, he wasn't in Green Bay at the end. If I'm betting, I'd bet he would. I just can't imagine that you get the next year this time after all of that, and you go, yeah, I'm good with the fact that I got 4 snaps and 75 seconds, and then that was how my career ended. I don't think anyone can picture that.
What were your big takeaways from week one other than Monday night?
I mean, the headlines to me were Tua and Tyreek, and, you know, what that looks like with Tua's healthy. We've seen games like that. I'd be really interested to see how they do this week against New England. New England largely boxed up Philadelphia. You know, that offense didn't do a whole lot against the Patriots. They had a pick six, and, you know, they ended up hanging on and winning by too many if you took New England, thanks to a two-point conversion that got a flag on it.
Yeah.
Neither here nor there. But I think the way Miami looked was interesting. Dallas's defense was clearly the singular storyline from any one unit. Like, you have to ask yourself, is this a Dallas is that good or New York's that bad type of deal? I imagine it's probably a little bit of both. It almost always is. And then I just think there was, frankly, a lot of just kind of, I don't know, close games, but not really entertaining games, you know? The Broncos and the Raiders, the Saints and the Titans, the Commanders and the Cardinals. I mean, yeah, these are all close games, but none of them were what you'd call brisk, well-played affairs.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, I talked about how not only was it low scoring, but basically almost every single game in the league, with the exception of the Monday night game, ended with, you know, quarterbacks taking knees. And, you know, sometimes that happens after, you know, a last-second field goal, but the close games weren't kind of walk-off games either.
Close doesn't always mean really entertaining. Yeah, it just means they can be close kind of because everyone's sort of similarly futile.
But it is real football, and thank God we have that back.
I'm not complaining. You know, it just speaks to what we've always said. I mean, when you're ravenous for this, you know, it's like, all right, was it filet? No, it's kind of a ham sandwich. But, like, stack them up on the table. We all want to eat them.
How much of Washington, Arizona did you watch? And what are your thoughts of them week one?
Quite a bit. I mean, all I kept thinking was they can't lose this football game. You just can't. I know you were there. You and I talked off air about just, you know, there's buy-in from the crowd and people are excited, and that's great. I mean, the defense is really good, we know. I don't know how much you learn going up against Joshua Dobbs and that Arizona team. It's pretty limited. The Howell thing, I don't know. I mean, the turnover before halftime, you just can't make a mistake in that spot. I get what they were trying to do. You had enough time to make something happen. I just think I walked away from a comment kind of shrugging and going, all right, well, they didn't lose, so that's all that matters in the NFL. And they say the biggest jump's typically made from week one to week two, and I think you're hoping to see that if you're a Washington fan. You know, you're hoping to see the offense have something. They didn't have much going the other day.
All right, let's flip it to college football real quickly. How good's the Deion Sanders story been for the sport here in the first 2 weeks?
It's amazing. I mean, look, Fox is all in. They took their pregame show there and just didn't leave.
I know.
Which was fascinating. They set up shop out there in Boulder, and did the pregame before the game they had last week, and then they said, we're not leaving. And then game day said, well, we're coming, and it's our game, so what are we doing here? Which I don't know how they sorted it out behind the scenes, who gets to set up where. It's just, you know, kind of very inside the Beltway, our industry pissing match, but who gets to have their set where. But ESPN's fired up because they've got, I think they've got Oregon, ABC has Oregon, Colorado the following week. And, I mean, he's, I think every school that wondered about him and what it might look like if you signed up for all that comes with Deion, and that's not a negative. I just mean he is a massive self-promoter, which I'm sure you're happy to have be part of what you get, because it's made Colorado football relevant in a way it hasn't been in forever. But I think if you're one of these schools last offseason to kind of kick the tires on, you know, should we hire this guy? Like, I mean, Colorado's been the singular story of the season. And it, granted, it's a couple weeks in, but it's amazing. His son's excellent. Hunter's is, you know, I saw a column today about how he's sort of college football Shohei Ohtani, right? He's a two-way guy with the massive impact both places. We'll see what happens when they in the next coming weeks when they play Oregon and USC. Colorado State can't do it; they're not going to beat them. But after that, all right, now you're in the ring with people that are not just in your weight class; they might have a few pounds on you, right? So that's when we'll start to really see what it is. But I don't know. I love the dude. I always have gotten a kick out of sort of who he is, and he's energized. He's energized the sport in a totally different way.
Yeah, I've always been a fan too, and he wins at virtually everything he does. We'll see what happens.
Me too. Like,
at
that's
Oregon.
Always the thing.
Yeah.
If you don't like, if you're not, if you don't dig it, like, what is it? What? I'd be curious what it is. And you know, maybe people that are, you know, old school or whatever. I mean, that stuff always kind of feels like it's kind of coded to me. Like, you know, is that what is it you really don't like? You know, I've always been admired just the talent, which was one thing, but then I thought he would pivot into our business the way he did, where he's a star doing that, and now, you know, he's a star in an ability to attract young players and give them this stage where, you know, again, it's early, but you know, they're just, guys are just showing out, you know. And how long will it continue? If it keeps going, I mean, the hype train will get just to the levels we haven't ever really seen.
Yeah, I don't know that I wouldn't describe it as coded. I think that there are people that are old school that don't like loudmouths, but loudmouths that have consistently backed it up their entire professional life, you know, as a player and now as a coach. Like, to me, that's... Look, if he's going to – and by the way, loudmouth is, you know, is a subjective thing. He is, to me, very quick, very funny quick, obviously very bright. And then on top of that, the dude just wins at everything he does and is arguably the greatest cornerback in the history of the National Football League.
Well, for sure. And then he pivoted to baseball and you know, was able to do that at the highest possible level. I just mean, I mean, anytime you say loudmouth and it happens to be a black man, then it can become, well, what do you mean? Well, your point's well taken. You could just mean, you're just a loudmouth. I'm not saying it has anything to do with you being a black guy. And there were people that framed, like, people cussing at him at TCU, and does this happen to white guys? Were you joking? Like, the entire LSU stadium's chanting F Nick Saban. Of course it happens. It happens to,
right.
In college football, like, yeah. When you're at a certain level, then you're going to get the worst of it. The worst types of behavior from fans, unfortunately, comes with it. But listen, you said it well. He's won at pretty much everything. He's won at everything he's done. And the question is, how long can he win? Like, if they're a bowl team, which it certainly appears at minimum they will be after winning a game last year, then flipping the roster entirely has worked at a level that the game now affords you the opportunity to do, you know. It's kind of, does every school want to, you know, see their entire roster get flipped every year? Of course not. But I think we all understand that the student athlete day and the idea of 4 years, you're going to go to school in the same place. Like, it just doesn't happen. The portal and all that allows a turnaround like this. You just need an attraction like Deion Sanders and, excuse me, Coach Prime.
Coach.
Is that officially his name? Like, literally, like Gus, I think, just kept calling. I think it's just Coach Prime.
Well, maybe he'll become a symbol at some point, just a symbol. You know, I
work for Prince.
In thinking about Deion, like, I've always gotten the biggest kick out of Deion, and it makes me think of how much I actually miss Mike Leach and how much the sport will miss Mike Leach, you know, and what. And what an absolute quote machine, and how entertaining he was, and by the way, how good of a coach he was.
Interesting. Those aren't people you would necessarily think of as a comparative model. But you know, Mike was an innovator, and Mike was funnier than hell, and Mike didn't care what you thought. That's for sure.
Did not give a shit. Yeah.
No, he did not.
So, by the way, this weekend's a good weekend. Week four, the weekend of September, it would be the 23rd, Saturday the 23rd. Have you seen the lineup of games? You already mentioned Colorado, Oregon on ABC, but that day features Iowa, Penn State, Ohio State, Notre Dame, Colorado, Oregon, Florida State, Clemson. I think UCLA and Utah play that day. The Pac-12.
You're right. No, I was looking at them last night, and week four is great. But you know the thing that happens, Kevin, and you know as well as I do because we're old, that the weeks where you get caught looking down the road at what's coming next week is where somebody big is going to stub their toe.
So who stubs their toe this weekend?
Who?
Yeah.
I mean, we always look for you look for the spots. I don't think it's Penn State because I think that this quarterback they've got different. But you go on the road and take on an Illinois team that struggled at home with Toledo and then got thumped at Kansas. I mean, it's the kind of spot that I think is always a little bit concerning if you're the higher rated team, right? You go into you're the ranked team on the road, your first conference game, first road game. You know, those spots are the ones that always kind of jump out and look like maybe that's a spot where you could get got. I think Kansas State at Missouri is a tricky spot.
Yep.
I think Tennessee at Florida for sure. I mean, I'm certain I'll have Florida in winners just on general principle. There's some spots there's always a spot for that. But you're right. Obviously, the schedule next weekend is loaded top to bottom with teams from the same sort of space.
Yeah, the Penn State-Illinois game really stands out, as does K-State-Missouri. By the way, our general principle games are 0-2. South Alabama and Nebraska may have been the all-time high-profile general principle game on Saturday.
And I agree. Look, totally agree. I'll say, I don't know if I said it on the show or on Twitter, or maybe I just thought it and didn't say it, but if you're Vegas, you better figure this shit out, because if Vegas isn't in the business of opening up the drawer to the till for people to just come grab this full of cash, but they're going to line up and wait for you to open the doors to fire on Colorado every week until you figure out what the number's supposed to be. And giving them away last week at 3 in a game against the Nebraska team who you gave them out, I gave them out, I'm watching the game. I mean, it's, if Nebraska had any sort of quarterback play, the game was there to be a four quarter close game if Nebraska could have figured it out, but they couldn't. But Colorado's going to win by more than 3, so you better make your numbers right, because I mean, I'm sure people are lining up to fire on them this week, and why wouldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think what they saw was they were going to play a team that was really good defensively, and they played a team that basically had like 4 players in the box the entire game in the opener against TCU, and they just shredded it. But they didn't account for Jeff Sims being as bad as any quarterback could possibly be in a football game, because they certainly looked like the right side through midway through the second quarter.
Yeah, but then, you know, to quote the head ball coach, not very good. It was not a sound performance in the quarterbacking game for the Cornhuskers.
No, it was a rough outfit offensively on Saturday for Nebraska.
It was.
What do you make of the Terps so far? And Friday night, I mean, I was actually kind of looking forward to this when we found out that they were going to play, you know, an old ACC rival in football on Friday night. But Virginia stinks.
Yeah, they're on the struggle bus for sure. I mean, here's what I'd say, and I know that yours is a show, Kevin, with massive reach here in the area. the weather's supposed to be perfect, like fall perfect. In the 70s during the day, upper 50s at night. It's an old ACC rival. If they're good, if they're not, whatever. I believe they've sold a bunch of tickets, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of Virginia people in the building. Come to the game. You know, we know the myriad of reasons. Well, there's the Ravens and there's the Commander. Fine. We know there are a lot of options in it. Fine. You could make every excuse you want to make. But you could also go buy a ticket. You can get one for not a lot of money, and you could cheer for the Terps. If you're a Maryland fan and you don't get out there, then I don't know what's ever going to get you out there. You know, this team's, are they Ohio State or Penn State? No, they're trying to get there. You know, these are the types of games where getting behind them, filling the stadium, showing some support for Locks and this team would really help, because it can be difference making. You know, it truly can be difference making at some point. They might need to lean on the crowd actually sticking around for four quarters. And I'm not talking to the students. I'm talking to the old.
I know.
The olds need to do better here.
We do this every time we want there to be a bigger crowd for a game in a spot like this. And, look, you and I sat in that box, in Turgeon's box, for the Penn State game. And when it was 21-0, we left. So let's not act like we haven't done that before. But more importantly, what do you make of the team? Because
I'm making this plea to call to action to the constituency, and you're asking what do I think of the team. I really don't know how you know. 14-0 to Charlotte was obviously not what anyone had in mind. The fact that the defense was a whole lot better the rest of the way, and the offense did enough to win. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to win that game, and they did ultimately fairly comfortably. And I don't know what you really learned against Virginia. I assume you'll get their best. You'll learn more in this game than you have in either of the first two. But I just don't know how to honestly answer the question or evaluate them based on what they've seen. I think the offensive line will continue to be a work in progress and the main issue. I think defensively they've got enough to be competitive. They've got skill position players. It's certainly, you know, quarterbacks, receivers, and running back position that are going to give them a chance to score points. And this week, I don't think that they're going to just blow the doors off Virginia. And then next week you hit the road and take on Michigan State. You know, you're going to learn, you know, I'm talking about Colorado. You're going to learn more about them in the coming weeks. You'll learn more about Maryland as well. Maybe to some degree beginning Friday. I mean, I just would expect Virginia to come in and play better than they have in the first two games.
All right. Thanks for doing this. Oh, you've got a doubleheader Monday night. So where will you be?
When they have two games like that, they don't go to a venue. I'll go up to Connecticut on Monday. So the next two Mondays will be in the studios doing countdown for. It's a combination show for both shows. Does that make sense? I mean, for both games, rather. And then I'll just stay there to do SportsCenter from the studio. And then the next time we're back out on the road is week four, when it's same venue, Meadowlands. It'll be the Giants and the Seahawks, who collectively played two just absolute ass games. And I believe Seattle had 180 yards of offense, and the Giants had one of the singular worst performances ever. So let's hope that we get things buttoned up between now and week four.
Well,
we're off to a huge rating start. We need to continue to deliver the big numbers.
Two doubleheaders the next 2 weeks on Monday Night Football. And then, by the way, just if you didn't know, that Giants game in the Meadowlands, a lot of people that we know will be attending that game, including Grande, who's coming up for that game.
Well, that's fantastic. Have him come down the field. They
well, they
on the
you
show.
Know
we'll get
the, 19. The, all of those guys go to one giant game, a Monday night game, if it's at Monday, if they have a Monday night game, and they've been doing that for years. So yeah, you'll have even more fans. You'll have familiar fans at that giant game.
We're happy to have anyone that likes us at all. We're happy to have them alongside.
All right, I'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Sounds good. We'll see you.
Scott Van Pelt, everybody. Up next, Mark Zuckerman on the extension given to Mike Rizzo. And I'll also ask Zuck about this whole Strasburg retirement thing. That's next, right after these words from a few of our sponsors. Football season is finally here. If you're looking for a spot to watch your favorite teams battle it out, head to Due South Dockside in Navy Yard, right on the Capitol Riverfront Boardwalk, with a stocked bar, draft beer, and a menu full of Due South house-smoked barbecue favorites. Their waterside location is the perfect place to gather all season long or to host your next event. Come on down, do the queue at Due South. Menus and more at DueSouthDC.com. Guys, great barbecue at Due South. And it's another place right near Nats Park, a place where you can go before or after the game, but an exceptional menu, a real fun place to hang out for a bite to eat. Again, DueSouthDC.com for more information. Speaking of Nats Park, we're going to finish up with what I promised at the beginning of the show, and that is our good friend Mark Zuckerman, who covers the team for Masson Sports. You can read his stuff at MassonSports.com or just get it at his Twitter page, at Mark Zuckerman on Twitter. So Mike Rizzo signs a multi-year contract extension. It seemed a little bit weird here, Mark, over the last month and a half, or maybe it's the last month at this point, where Davey signed his contract extension. We thought it was going to be Rizzo. Just tell us how the whole thing played out and your thoughts on Rizzo staying in D.C.
Well, I think the order of this was a little unusual. You don't normally see the manager or coach get his deal before the GM does, because the GM is part of the deal to, the decision to retain a manager or a coach. So the timing was a little odd. When it did happen 3 weeks ago, the sense I got was that while there wasn't a deal done at that point, they were moving towards it and still had some details to work out. Now, according to Rizzo himself, he wanted to get Davey done first. He felt like that was important for the clubhouse chemistry. He didn't want a lame duck manager. And then he felt like they would get to his eventually, and he was never all that concerned that it wouldn't get done. I was the same way. I knew even if it took a while, there was little reason to believe that they wouldn't ultimately work something out. Now, in the interim, they made some changes to their front office. Some scouts were let go or reassigned, and that led to some people wondering if there might be some discord there and some problems. I don't think there was anything all that out of the ordinary. I think it was probably a case of Rizzo negotiating with the Lerner family what he was looking for, them offering what they were going to offer. I think some of that may have been, hey, we want you to make some changes. You've had a lot of people in positions for a while, and things always haven't worked out for the best. Let's try something different. So maybe it took some time to get that done. But in the end, it made too much sense. There was no reason for him to want to go anywhere else. There was no reason for the Lerners to want anyone else in this position. My feeling has always been, the day they traded Juan Soto, I think that meant you had to give Mike Rizzo, and Davey Martinez for that matter, several years now to go through the rebuild and see if they can pull this thing off. I don't think it would have been fair to evaluate them for their performance when you've torn down the roster and told them you need to start all over again. So 2 years from now, it's a different story. But for now, I think it makes all the sense in the world that both these guys should have the opportunity now to see this thing through and see if they can turn them into a winner again.
Is Mike Rizzo a top 10 baseball general manager?
I think so. I mean, he's the third longest tenured GM now in the sport, which is pretty amazing.
Who's been longer? Cashman? Who else?
Brian Cashman in New York and John Mozeliak in St. Louis are the only two.
Got it.
Kenny Williams with the White Sox had been there longer. He was just fired a few weeks ago,
right,
actually. So in this business, it's very rare to have this opportunity. And I think even rarer for someone to build a team up once, win a World Series, then tear it all down and be given the opportunity to do it all over again. Those other guys, you know, the Yankees are pretty much always expecting to be competitive. Same for the Cardinals. Now, this year, the Cardinals have fallen apart, and Mozeliak may be in a position for the first time to have to rebuild. So I think Rizzo is pretty unique in that regard. Now, I think there are people in the sport that would say he's a little too old school, and there are a lot of young up-and-comers with backgrounds that aren't even in baseball, but in finance and in analytics and all those things who are the new wave of this. He is kind of a relic in that his background is all scouting and came up through the ranks that way and has, you know, stood the test of time as a 62-year-old still doing this job. So I think there are some that would say he's not the future. That's not the way that most teams are going. But I think what he has accomplished is right up there with anyone. And, you know, this is a conversation for another day, but if he does see this thing through, and let's say they do build a winner again, maybe even go to or win another World Series, this could be a pretty interesting case for him for Cooperstown someday.
Yeah,
if
right.
He does it. A huge if. I'm not
there. I know, but that, how many general managers in the history of the sport have done it twice with completely different rosters and managers?
Right, exactly. And not going to different teams. You've had guys who've gone to different teams
right.
and won. But with the same team, and like I said, to have the opportunity to build a winner, then tear it down and start all over again, it's pretty unique, I think, in the sport.
Yeah, I mean, let's pump the brakes because he hasn't done it yet, and he's not anywhere right. near there right now. By the way, as it relates to him, and I had him on the podcast maybe a month or so ago, I like him a lot. Of the executives in town that I know or have had relationships with over the years, he's one of my favorite people because he's just genuine, and he is a competitive grinder. You know, it's just the way he is kind of built. And by the way, he loves this city. You know, he's not from here. He's from the Midwest, and he loves this city. But what do you think he hurt him more? And I'm not talking about what they got back in return or how it will be judged down the road because we can't even talk about Soto now. Trading Harper or trading Soto?
Oh, boy. I think they both hurt, obviously, for you know, good reason. I think the Harper one probably was softened by knowing that you had a lot of really good talent already, and obviously they won a World Series the next year. So, you know, not to say that they didn't want to keep Harper, that he couldn't have been a part of that. But I think he, you know, at least understood, okay, we're still in good shape, in part because of Soto, in fact. The trade of Soto, I think, was really hard because, number one, this is a kid they found in the Dominican Republic. Johnny DePuglia, who is no longer with them, by the way, their international scouting director for a long time. They turned him very quickly into not just a big leaguer, but an elite all-time big leaguer who performed at an incredible level right from the start, helped them win a World Series, and then so early on, you know, with 3 years almost to go before he could become a free agent, having to deal him for prospects, I think that was a really bitter pill for him to swallow. I think he knew in the end that it made sense from a baseball standpoint, but I think personally it hurt him because this is a once-in-a-lifetime player that they discovered. You know, Bryce Harper was going to go number one that right. year, no matter who had that pick. It's not like it was hard to make that decision. They had to find Juan Soto and turn him into the player that he was, and then to have to let him go the way they did, I think that one probably, you know, deep down hurt him a little bit more.
One of the other reasons I wanted to have you on today is I just would like you, who covers the team on a daily basis, to explain to me and everybody else out there listening why the Steven Strasburg retirement thing that was supposed to happen here recently hit a snag.
Oh, boy. Yeah, there's a lot to this one as well. And Rizzo talked about it. He was asked about it at his you know, press conference to announce the deal. Basically, let's go backwards here a little bit. Over the winter, last winter, I was told that Strasburg was essentially feeling fine and doing well and wanted to give it essentially one more try to pitch. And the understanding was that if he got to a point that he started throwing off a mound and it just wasn't working, he knew that was probably the end of the road. And sure enough, that's what happened. Didn't even make it to spring training, and then we found out the first day of spring training what had happened. So I really do believe from that moment, he knew and the team knew that his career was over. Now, the problem is it's not as simple as just announcing that and deciding that. If you are a major league player and you voluntarily decide to retire, you forfeit the rest of your contract. I know baseball contracts are guaranteed, but you can't just walk away whenever you want and expect to be paid everything you're owed. If he had announced the day after he signed his contract that he was retiring, he wouldn't deserve that money. You can't do that. So he couldn't just say, okay, I'm done. Now, there's contingencies in there if you suffer a debilitating injury and can no longer perform, which is pretty clearly what has happened to him, that you can work things out with the team and with the league to make sure that you get paid. It's a complicated process. The sense I got was that 3 weeks ago, whatever it is now, the word got out. He had let them know. They had worked this out and said, okay, he's done playing and we've probably figured out whatever the financial aspects of this all are, and so we're going to start to make plans for a press conference. Now, I think what was maybe mistakenly assumed at that point was that they already did have a deal in place of how they were going to work this out, whether it was him sacrificing some of the salary or whether it was just them spreading it out to lessen the blow of it. Apparently that had not happened, or not to the full extent, and Major League Baseball is involved. There is a whole process through the CBA that you have to go through for all of this. And so while there was a tentative plan for a press conference this past Saturday, it was never officially said it was going to happen. Anytime I and the rest of us would ask about it, they said, well, you know, leave that date open, but don't put it in stone. It's not for sure. And then I think about 2 days prior, we got the word like, no, it's actually not happening yet. Now, I do think it will happen at some point. It's a complicated process. I think the back and forth, what you've seen both publicly said and privately said from both sides of the equation, and I'm not talking about Steven here, I'm talking about Scott Boras, and then the statement that Mark Lerner put out has made it look kind of nasty and shows that there is a fight over some money, or at least the process of how they're going to decide how much he gets and how much they spread it out over. That's unfortunate. They all, I think, realize that now, how that has come across. I do think ultimately they will figure something out. He's not going to attempt to pitch again. He's not coming to spring training and trying to pitch again. They all know that is not the case. But it's going to take a little while longer for them to actually finalize whatever the terms of this agreement are going to be.
Yeah, for those that missed it, because I read this over the weekend and there was just too much football to kind of discuss it early in the week, but Mark Lerner had some interesting statements about all of this. He said some nice things. Steven Strasburg is and always will be an important part of the Nationals franchise. We support him in any decision that he makes and will ensure that he receives what is due to him. It's regrettable that private discussions have been made public through anonymous sources attempting to negotiate through the media. And then he said the following. It is our hope that ongoing conversations remain private out of respect for the individuals involved. Until then, we look forward to seeing Steven when we report to spring training. I mean, that is a little bit of a threatening statement there. It's like, either get it together or we'll see in spring training. Be ready to play.
Yeah, that was the way I interpreted it. I think that's the way everybody interpreted it. And you know, think of it in these terms. It's essentially a threat, or it appears as a threat.
Right.
Okay, fine. You don't want to sacrifice any of the money. You don't want to change the terms of your contract. Well, then you have to live up to your part of the contract, and that means you have to report to spring training and continue your rehab, quote-unquote, and attempt to pitch again. Now, deep down, nobody ever thought that would happen, and I was surprised at that line. I think a lot of people were taken aback by it. Now, Mike Rizzo today, both with us and then when he was on with the Junkies in the morning, tried to walk that back and say that's not at all what Mark Lerner meant. He meant that he wants Steven to still continue to be a part of the team and work with young players the way that Ryan Zimmerman has in retirement and all that. Well, that may be true. It's not exactly Steven's personality to be somebody who's going to be around a lot and very visible in retirement. Maybe he will. I would be a little surprised by that. Even if that's all true, the wording of that statement, which I'm sure was not just slapped together, that was read over by many people, probably a lawyer included. That seemed to be, not what they were trying to say, and could have been said a lot better if that's truly what you meant. I think that was kind of a threat to Scott Boras and some frustration with what I assume they believe Scott Boras leaking things out about these negotiations and being frustrated with the quote-unquote cancellation of the press conference. And so that's where it got nasty. I hope that it doesn't damage their relationship with Strasburg. It shouldn't. They've been too strong with each other for too long. I hope the cooler heads prevail here. But that statement definitely raised a lot of eyebrows around the sport, and I think really caught people off guard because it's so out of character for Mark Lerner to make any kind of statement
right.
publicly, let alone something like that.
So just real quickly, how much is left on his $245 million deal? How much do they owe him?
After this year, it's 3 years and about $105 million.
So 3 years and $105 million. So,
right.
I mean, if they're going to pay him the rest of it, what do they want? Do they want to spread it out over a longer period of time and defer it for longer? What exactly is the negotiation between Strasburg and the team over what is owed Strasburg? Because his career is ending because of a debilitating injury. It's not retirement.
Right. And let's also make clear that the team could have taken out an insurance policy, chose not to. That's very cost prohibitive, and there's reasons why they didn't do it. If they did, this isn't really an issue anymore because insurance is going to cover the majority of that. But they did not, so they're on the hook for the money. My sense was that their preference would be to try to get him to agree to space it out, and that maybe over time it actually decreases the value of the total
sure.
value of it all. So that would maybe be the compromise. I don't think anybody really felt like he was going to sacrifice money or give any of it back. But let's be clear, this is pretty unprecedented. There have been other players who have been forced into retirement early who had long-term deals. Most of them were maybe a year left to go, like Chris Davis with the Orioles. Prince Fielder had a similar situation. I remember years ago when I first started working here, Albert Bell had a degenerative hip and had to retire early. The Orioles had insurance on his contract, so it didn't really matter. So this is an odd situation, to say the least. And here's the key point of it all. They need to resolve something, and relatively soon, because Steven has spent the whole year on the 60-day IL, which is not a problem. But when the season ends, everybody comes off the IL and has to be placed on the 40-man roster for the entire winter. They cannot afford to waste a spot on him all winter, a spot that would go to a prospect or a free agent or someone else. Those are precious spots over the course of the offseason. They cannot afford to waste a spot on that. So they do need to figure out something relatively soon. They can't just wait for 3 years and keep him stashed on the IL all this time. That would not do the Nationals any good.
Do most teams take out an insurance policy on big contracts like that?
I think it was more common years ago. I think it's less so now. What I was told about this months ago when I asked about it as this was kind of starting to crop up was it costs so much. The premiums are so high.
What are the premiums?
Almost,
do you know?
Like potentially $10 million plus. That's what we're talking about.
Okay.
In addition to the contract. Now, in the end, would it have been better to get that? Sure. But you don't know that. And the other thing I was told is a lot of times the insurance companies won't even insure the part of the body that would be important here, like his arm.
Like the most
for
risky.
Example.
Yeah.
And it might just be, well, we'll insure him if he gets into a motorcycle accident and breaks his leg, something like that.
Got
so
it.
It's not as easy as it sounds. I know you want to say, oh, just take out the insurance. What I was told is it's not as simple as that sounds.
I hope that this gets resolved in a way where Steven Strasburg can be honored for being the clutch player and the postseason pitcher that he was for this franchise. I know we've talked about this previously, but the idea that somehow Steven Strasburg's career fell short of what people thought it would be, maybe in terms of Cy Young's and regular season, but his pitching in the postseason is what this franchise has as its history now. I mean, at the top of the list is Game 6 in Houston. You know, is the game, at Wrigley in the postseason. he's the guy. He came through more than Scherzer did in the postseason, and I hope that they figure this thing out and it ends amicably so that he can be honored in the right kind of way.
Yeah, I believe it will. I think we'll see something probably next year where they have an official number retirement ceremony, and 37 will go up there alongside number 11. I mean, look, the everyone's favorite player in Nationals history is probably Zimmerman, for good reason. The best player in Nationals history is probably Max Scherzer, who is going to be a Hall of Famer and most likely have a curly W on his cap. But I think there's a case that Steven is the most important player in Nationals history. He came about at a time when they needed somebody like that to change the narrative of the franchise, to turn them into a team that was actually on the national radar, to then live up to all the hype, and then perform, as you just said, in the biggest moments. They don't win a World Series without him. So I do believe he is the most important player, and I think ultimately, probably sometime next year, as things calm down here, they will do that, and he will be honored. And I do believe that fans understand what he meant to them and won't be looking at the contract or the times he didn't pitch. I think they ultimately understand just how important and what he meant to the franchise, and they'll honor him as such.
I wouldn't sell in the conversation of the greatest player to ever play for the franchise. I'm talking about here in Washington, second go-round, the Expos, this team. Bryce Harper short in that conversation. He had an MVP. He had another phenomenal season. He was the rookie of the year, right? I think he was.
And is on a Hall of Fame track now.
No doubt. And he was their, you know, along with Strasburg in those early playoff years, he was a clutch performer. I mean, that series against the Giants when they couldn't generate anything offensively, he was their lone offensive player. He was the player that generated, I think, the most. I think maybe Rendon had a couple of hits in that series, but they couldn't generate anything other than what Harper did.
Yeah, no, you're right. It was the two of them and nobody else, and Harper was even better than Rendon, hitting bombs off Hunter Strickland into McCovey Cove. So, no, you're right. And I think that the difference there, and it's unfortunate, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, if and when Bryce goes into the Hall of Fame, he's going to be wearing a Phillies cap and not a Nationals cap.
Yeah, unfortunately. Last thing real quickly, tell us about Jackson Rutledge, who's going to make his pitching debut tonight for the Nats.
He was their first-round pick in 2019, 17th overall. It's been a little slower path to the big leagues for him. He had some injuries. He didn't pitch especially well for a few years in the minors. So it is kind of an organizational win for him to finally prove that he was ready for this. And he earned it, working his way up the ladder at AA and AAA this year. He's not the top pitching prospect. This isn't Cavalli's debut, certainly not Strasburg's debut, anything like that. But a big, tall, 6'8" right-hander with good stuff who can be a part of this in the future. And if nothing else, you know, they went there from pretty much Anthony Rendon in 2011 until maybe now Rutledge in 2019, where none of their top first-round picks really amounted to much, either for them or for other organizations. Lucas Giolito did a little bit for the White Sox before his career kind of fell apart as well. They need more success stories from their own draft picks who've developed through their own system. They've got a couple the last few years who they believe are going to do that. Rutledge is a chance to also rectify that and show that they do know how to scout and develop and turn guys into quality big leaguers.
Thank you for doing this, as always. It's much appreciated.
My pleasure, Kevin. Anytime.
All right, that is it for the day. Back tomorrow with Tommy.
With two out, nobody on, here's Bregman, who has an infield hit and a home run. This one off the end of the bat. Strasburg has taken his team through eight. What a night for the 31-year-old right-hander, Stephen Strasburg. Ninth inning now, game six. Nationals bat up three.